song through its doors, just as if it seems to know I'm exclusively yours. Knowing this, I feel but one way. You will understand it too, in these words that I say. I'll close my eyes to everyone but you, and when I do, I'll see you standing there. A new love affair, then I'll close my eyes to everything that's gay. If you are not there, to share each lovely day, and through the years, and those moments when we're far apart, don't you know I'll close my eyes, and I'll see you with my heart.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello again, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus. We're also on the web at kuci.org, and we are on iTunes. If you go to radio, scan down to talk, or public, maybe it's under public, and then look for KUCI. We're there, and we're podcasting as well. If you go to my website, penonfire.com, click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen, you'll arrive at the radio page. There you will see instructions for reaching the archive shows, the podcasts, listening live, all sorts of things. This show should go up in a few weeks at most, and will be available 24/7 for you to listen to again. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing, as always, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. And today my guest for the entire hour is Marisa de los Santos. Sorry about that. Marisa de los Santos is an award-winning poet. Her first collection of poems, From the Bones Out, was published by the University of South Carolina Press in 2000, and her work has appeared in numerous publications, including Poetry and Southwest Review. She lives in Delaware with her husband and two children. We're going to be talking today primarily about her first novel, Love Walked In, published by Plume. We'll be talking a little bit about her novel coming out soon, Belong to Me, published by William Morrow. And if you want to know more about her, go to her website, which is lovewalkedin.com. Hi, Marisa.
Hi, how are you?
Great, great to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
You know, I'm curious. You started out as a poet, it seems. And talk about transitioning to fiction.
It was a transition I really never expected to make. I would have always liked to have made it. But I was really a poet. You know, I got an MFA in poetry, and then I went to the University of Houston and got a PhD in literature and creative writing, and my dissertation was a book of poems. That's what I always did. I never attended fiction workshops. I never really in my adult life wrote a short story before I wrote Love Walked In. So,
that's unusual.
Huh?
That's quite unusual, isn't it?
I think it is.
Yeah.
I've since met a couple of poets who became novelists. But it is. I think it's pretty unusual. I think people often start with short stories, and a short story is just something that I haven't written since I was a kid. So, mm-hmm. As a reader, I have always been a huge devourer of novels. So, I would have liked to have written one before Love Walked In, but it wasn't in the cards. I didn't have a story to tell. And then a few years ago, I started to have ideas about a character, and really more than anything else, had a character's voice in my head that developed for a long, long time, close to a year probably. And eventually she took on, a few trappings of story, and then another character emerged who would become Claire, who's the 11-year-old girl.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, I think it was early one summer, I just decided to sit down and start writing the story, not committing myself to any genre, to any, I just said, let's just see what this is. And it took a while. It took maybe 4 months and 60 pages, or more than 4 months, probably, for me to be able to say, okay, I think I'm writing a novel, it was really a lark. Like, let's just sit down and see what happens with this.
Hmm. So, okay, so the characters came to you. How did the story unfold? Because there's a definite story here. There's a definite plot. How did that come into the mix?
Well, I mean, it's a little hard to say how it came to me or why it happened when it did. I mean, part of the story, Claire is 11, and her mother she lives alone with her mother. They have a very close relationship. And at some point, her mother starts to behave strangely and then increasingly strangely. And Claire's not sure what's happening. She feels like her mother is turning into this other person who's at best unpredictable and often, occasionally, particularly toward the end with her mother, scary, not abusive, but just so erratic that it's scary for Claire. And that part of the story came from my experience as a kid. I mean, it was quite different. I was older. I was 14. My father lived with us. My parents are still together. I had a younger sister. I wasn't isolated the way Claire was. So that part of the story came at least a little bit from my own experience, but I'd had that experience since I was 14. I'd written poetry about it. I'd written essays. I had not ever seemed inclined to incorporate any of the elements of that experience into a novel, and then suddenly I was inclined to do that. And why it happened when it happened is it's a little hard to say. I mean, there were things going on in my life that were making poetry hard. I had a baby. I have two children who are now 8 and 5, and they were extremely difficult infants. Colicky is one of those catch-all phrases that really is pretty meaningless. It's applied so liberally that it doesn't really have any meaning anymore. But these babies basically cried all day long and didn't sleep at night. And I was so tired. And even when I could write, and I was dying to write, the kind of what is for me a very, very extreme kind of focus, an obsessive kind of focus, is required for poetry. I couldn't muster it, or I could, but not very frequently, and it was very hard to do it. So the poems started to get fewer, further between, and then this character kind of started talking to me in my head with no story. And her story emerged really, I think, just from who she became, you know, in my head. It's the best way I can explain it. She is a person who loves old movies, who lives in Philadelphia, who has a particular kind of family that she grew up in but is now living a very different kind of life from the life she grew up with. And her path crosses with this little girl, the path of this little girl who's in trouble. And things just kind of, I knew that about the story, and then it all kind of just unfolded as I wrote, you know. But I can't explain it. I don't know why I suddenly had a story to tell. Certainly my dad's a surgeon, and he's a very practical-minded guy, and he would say to me for years, like, okay, you're a writer, great, fine, but maybe you could write something that you could actually make some money at or that people would buy in a store. I said, you know, Daddy, this just seems to be what I do. And, you know, then suddenly I found myself writing a novel.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Marisa de los Santos. Her first novel is Love Walked In. So it's kind of funny to hear you say, I mean, it's not funny, haha, but, you know, it's just kind of interesting that you say that it was difficult to write poetry because you had two very young ones, and yet you started writing a novel.
You know, something happened to my brain. And again, it's not something that's clear even to me why this happened. You know, certainly fiction takes tremendous concentration, but there is a way in which once I started writing a novel, there was this kind of moment when I realized that this is really a kind of writing that's far better suited to who I am than poetry was, in that there's this big space to move around in. With poetry, for me, it was really, and maybe for everybody, it's all about the right word, finding the right word. And I would obsess, you know, about this for days, weeks, you know, months even, about getting the right word. And then you get the right word, and the poem comes alive. If you don't get the right word, the poem's just dead in the water. And the kind of focus, what I always think about is, you know, the sun coming through a magnifying glass and burning a tiny hole in something. You know, it's just this intense kind of concentration. It wasn't that I couldn't concentrate anymore. It's that I didn't have that kind of concentration.
Mm-hmm.
So there's something about story. I mean, you know, you still want to hit the right word, and I still do that where I obsess over the right word. But if it's not coming, there are a lot of other things that you can do. You know, you can think about character and backstory of character, or you can think about plot. You can go back and revise what you've written already. You know, there's sort of a big space to move around in, and if your imagination is in a particular mode that day that doesn't lend itself to finding just a very, very specific word or moving commas around from place to place or whatever, you know, it took when I was writing poetry, there's always something it can be doing and can be working on. At least that's my experience with writing a novel. So poetry was beginning to feel claustrophobic, and I was starting to just not be able to do it very often. And with fiction, it's even something while I was doing things for my children or walking, or there was always a section of my brain that could be working on something.
Mm-hmm.
So it felt just more in keeping with who I was at that time in my life. And it seems to continue. I mean, it seems to be, I'm sort of addicted to writing novels now. And I'm working on a third, and just feel like I'm in my element. This suits me at this time in my life.
Hmm. Now, in terms of the practical side, then, of working on a novel with two small children, I think a lot of people I talk to, a lot of new writers especially, have a really hard time carving out the time for themselves, especially if they have a lot of demands on their time. So how did you do that? Did you find specific times, places during the day, during the week that you would work, or was it whenever you could grab a minute, or how did you do it?
Well, it continues to be challenging, you know, to find, because what I have a friend who's a novelist. If she has 10 minutes, she sits down and writes. I would find that I needed to get more momentum going than that, and I would actually need at least 2 consecutive hours, or, you know, ideally more than that in a day. While I wrote Love Walked In, I was also teaching. I was teaching at the University of Delaware full time. So it was tough. I mean, I started in the summer. I wasn't teaching in the summer. My kids, I have had a nanny who would come to our house and be with the kids for a few hours. But, you know, it was tough because I was working in the house. So it wasn't as though I were, you know, floating in some bubble of quiet somewhere where I could really focus. I think that what's happened with me as a writer is that I am so, I'm getting very efficient at using time, and because I have to be. So I can't really sit and take notes. I mean, I need to get moving quickly, and I've learned how to do that, and I've kind of learned how to make the most of my time. The frustrating days, now both my children are in school full day. My daughter's in kindergarten, so that's when I write. I write while they're at school, and which sounds like a lot of time, except that I still do all the things that, you know, you do. Like, I don't teach anymore, but I go to the grocery store and do laundry and do all that. And then I'm often doing something, a bunch of different things, usually to promote one of the other books. So that there's not that much time, but I value it. It's so precious to me that I really have figured out how to use it well. But the hard days are the days when it's not working, you know, the days when I have 4 straight hours to work. It feels like a miracle, and then it's not happening. It's not a good day for writing. And what I've really learned is that instead of sitting down and just banging my head against the computer for 4 hours, it's really much better for me to get up and go do something else. And sometimes when I'm doing some of those other things that always need doing, like grocery shopping or exercising or, you know, whatever, it can start, the juices flowing, and I can, if I can make it back to my desk that day, I can get stuff done. But sometimes the times when I'm not writing can be valuable, but it's still hard. It's still hard to think, okay, God, I have 4 hours today and I have nothing, you know. nothing on paper, nothing to show for it. It's tough. Luckily, I don't teach anymore. I mean, I don't know. I sometimes think about writing Love Walked In, and I think, how did I do that? You know, how did I teach and grade papers and prepare and have kids and write this book? And I think the book makes its own demands on you. I mean, in some ways, you know, you it's okay, now I need to write this chapter. Like, the book is making me write. I have to write this chapter, so I got to figure out, you know, I'll make the time for it. But and, you know, I have these certain rules. Like, I typically don't write on the weekends. I don't write in the after my kids are back from school, and I break the rules on occasion. But I try to give the time when I'm with my family to them, and so I'm not trying to do too many things at once. I'm sort of focusing on them. And that can be, you know, that can be a little hard. They're busy. I you know, they're busy people, and we do a lot of running around. And so you know, there's a limited space in each day when I could potentially get work done. But I've learned to, if the juices are flowing, I capitalize on it.
Well, at this point, I would love for you to read to us. That would be wonderful.
Okay. Well, I'll read from the beginning of Love Walked In. And I don't know how long you want me to go for.
Oh, a few minutes.
Okay. Well, I typically do a little skipping around. So it opens. Cornelia Brown is the manager of a coffee bar. She's this kind of overeducated and underemployed person who's waiting to figure out what her calling is in all kinds of ways in her life. And I think the part that I read, if I get this far, it has a piece of profanity in it that I will just, I'll just fudge it.
Yes.
Okay. My life, my real life, started when a man walked into it. A handsome stranger in a perfectly cut suit, and yes, I know how that sounds. My friend Linny would snort and convey the kind of multi-pronged disgust I rely on her to convey. One prong of feminist disgust at the whole idea of a man changing a woman's life, even though, as things turned out, the man himself was more the harbinger of change than the change itself. Another prong of disgust for the inaccuracy of saying my life began after 31 years of living it. And the final prong being a kind of general disgust for the way people turn moments in their lives into movie moments. I do this more than I should, I'll give her that. But there was something backlit, sudden, about his walking through the door of the cafe I managed. If the floor had been bare and not covered with tables, chairs, people, and dogs, the autumnal late morning sun would have flung his narrow shadow dramatically across the floor in a real Orson Welles shot. But Linny can jab me with her three-pronged disgust fork all she wants, and I'd still say that my life started on that October morning when a man walked through the door. It was an ordinary day, palpably ordinary, if that makes any sense, like it was asserting its smooth usualness. A Saturday, loud. Smoke already piling up and hovering like weather over me and the customers in Cafe Dora. So then Cornelia goes on to describe what is a pretty typical morning for her. She interacts with some of the regular customers, and I'll pick up a couple pages in. All of which is meant to demonstrate the ordinariness of the day and how the ordinariness was even taking on shades of dreariness and futility. Because you have to understand what my life was like in the before in order to see just how much it changed in the after. Ordinary, ordinary. Except that, and I honestly believe this, Linny's poo-pooing of movie moments notwithstanding, just before, a minute before the cafe door opened one more time, the ordinary day turned itself up a notch in preparation. The light falling through the high-arched windows went from mellow to brilliant, turning the old copper of the espresso machine to pure gold. And the music, Sarah Vaughan, whom I worship, singing George and Ira, whom I worship, was suddenly floating and dipping like some kind of bird in the clear space above the cigarette smoke and chit-chat. The coffee smelled sublime. The flowers I'd bought that morning pierced the air with their blueness. The coffee cups lost their chips and glowed eggshell thin, and standing in my red sweater and vintage suede skirt, my boots solidly on the floor, I felt almost tall. The door of Cafe Dora opened, and Cary Grant walked in. You want me to keep going?
You know, that's a great start. Thank you so much.
Sure.
Thank you. That was Marisa de los Santos reading from Love Walked In, published by Plume. And it's been optioned to be a movie.
Yeah. And this happened a long time ago, actually, before the book came out. Sarah Jessica Parker and Michael London are slated to co-produce. I believe Sarah Jessica was going to star in the movie, and they had an option, and then they renewed the option, and that's kind of where we stand now. So they're working on it. you know, it's Hollywood. So I'm not sure that many movies actually get made in Hollywood, but it's exciting.
I think we like that when it happens to novels. We like that a lot.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be great. So we'll see.
Well, we're going to take a real short break, and when we get back here, we will be back with more Marisa de los Santos, and stay with us.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama aching tears. Gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
The views and opinions expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're at the University of California, Irvine campus. We are on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Check out our podcasts. Go to penonfire.com. Click on the radio tower on the left side of the screen. You'll arrive at the radio page. At the top of the page, you'll see all sorts of instructions on how to find the podcasts, how to listen via iTunes, so on and so forth. And hopefully soon I will update the schedule even, and you'll get the schedule of upcoming guests. Geraldine Brooks is on in a couple weeks. Lots of good people coming up. And today we have the wonderful Marisa de los Santos. Her book is Love Walked In. Her second book is Belong to Me, out in April, Marisa?
That's right. Mm-hmm.
Tell me now, because you pick up in Belong to Me with Cornelia Brown, your main character of your first novel, was that a plan when you were working on Love Walked In that you were going to write more than one book featuring this character, or did that just sort of evolve in the writing of it?
No, it wasn't a plan. I mean, when I wrote Love Walked In, I really didn't have a plan. You know, this was somebody who had never written a novel, and really, I've learned a lot about it, but the whole kind of literary world in New York, I just knew nothing about it. And I did sort of know that you really probably, because I started, you know, it took about a year for Love Walked In to come out, and I started Belong to Me in that year before Love Walked In came out, and I no one really said this to me, but I realized that there's probably it isn't the wisest thing to write a follow-up to a novel that hasn't come out. They could, you know, easily crash and burn, and then you've, here you got a sequel that nobody wants to read. But what's interesting is I don't really feel that there's a lot of choice involved. I mean, it seems to me that the stories kind of come to me, and it's not like five of them come, and I can say, oh, well, you know, which one makes the most sense to work on? I kind of have the one idea, you know, and the book's, you know, tugging at me for me to write it, and that's what I do. So, and that's been the same with the third book. There just doesn't seem to be a lot of, you know, I mean, I'm writing it. Obviously, I'm making decisions about it. But the stories, there's an aspect of givenness to the stories, if that's the word, where they kind of happen to me in a way, and I think, okay, well, this is it. This is the story I have to write. So, and that happened with Belong to Me. And what's interesting is that even while I was writing it, yes, the character of Cornelia was a familiar character to me, and some of the other characters from Love Walked In make appearances in the book, it never felt like I was writing a continuation of that book. It takes place, first of all, over 2 years after Love Walked In ends, and it's a really different kind of book in pretty much every way. I mean, it's not a romance. There may be some relationships in it, but that you couldn't spin it as a romance. It's really a different book. It has a different atmosphere, different feel. It's not set in the city. It's set in an unnamed suburb of Philadelphia, a fairly remote suburb of Philadelphia. It's really a different kind of book altogether. And so while I was writing it, it didn't feel like I was writing a sequel, and I still don't think about it that way. But it just seemed like this was the story that I was given to write. And so I wrote it, and then luckily Love Walked In, you know, it seems that some people like it. And so it worked out, because had it crashed and burned, you know, here we'd be looking at a second book coming out with these same characters who nobody liked. And it hasn't turned out that way, thank goodness. But it wasn't really like I had options. At least that's not how I felt while I was writing.
Mm-hmm. Talk about the voice of Cornelia and Claire in Love Walked In anyway. And it seems that the voice continues with Cornelia in Belong to Me. It's a conversational, sort of friendly, personal, intimate kind of talking to the reader voice. Will you talk about how that came about, or how you chose it, if you had any choice in the matter?
Well, you know, Cornelia really began as a voice, and what's interesting is that maybe this is the poet in me, but she really, it wasn't even so much at first, at the very, very start. She was more of a syntax than anything else. She was sort of a structure, a way of talking. She goes off on tangents. She has these kind of, it could make a person crazy, probably, and probably does make some people crazy, but she really, it was almost a shape to her voice that came to me first. And then a particular kind of sense of humor, a certain kind of sensibility that was distinctly not mine, you know, really different from me. And so she started as a voice, and she really didn't have a story. So what Cornelia would do was sort of comment on what was going on around me, if I was watching the news, if I, you know, just sort of, oh, here's what Cornelia has to say about this. Here's how she would respond, and her responses weren't always in sync with my own. And it was a little weird. I was pretty sure I wasn't going insane. It just seemed like, you know, this character fell into my head from someplace and developed. And then she became a character with very distinct likes and dislikes, and then she had a story. But I think because she began as a voice talking to me, and almost that's how she just continued, and that it was very, very natural to write her that way. And it's interesting because people would say to me afterwards, I'm talking about like early readers, friends, or my husband, and say, "Yeah, I like it when she directly addresses me." And I'd say, "Is she doing that?" Like, I didn't even really. It's not like I said, "Oh, you know what? I think I'm going to have a protagonist who is first person and who addresses the reader." It just was a very natural kind of organic thing that happened to me as I wrote, where she did this. And yes, intimate is right. And she's a person for whom really knowing people and really connecting with them and communicating with them is a big deal. So it would make sense to me that she would, you know, that she would have this kind of intimate way of speaking and way of telling her story. And then Claire is actually in third person. And I mean, my initial thought is that, you know, Cornelia's in first and Claire would be in first too. And then every time I would sit down to write Claire in first, I would find myself slipping into third. Until I just said to myself, okay, well, let's do this. Let's try this in third and see what happens. And it kind of fell into place. Everything sort of fell into place, and it felt very right to write it that way. But Claire's third is a very narrow third person. There have even been people who said, "Oh, well, I didn't even realize that she wasn't talking to me." I mean, you're so in her, so much in her head, and so seeing the world in a very limited way through her eyes, so that we never know anything she doesn't know. If we do, it's because we're reading between the lines, not because, we get information that she doesn't get. We never get inside anyone else's head except Claire's head. So it's really narrow, and it just somehow was, the way that her story needed to be told. So that's how that happened. And then in the second book, yes, Cornelia is the only first-person voice in that book, and that book actually has more characters who have their own stories, but she's the only first-person voice in that book. But it functions, I think, differently for me in Belong to Me, because she's almost a Greek chorus. I mean, she's very specific. She's very individual. But there's a way in which she's the spirit of the book. She's not necessarily, at least not till the last third, the character who is going through dramatic changes, or her story is unfolds more slowly than, say, this character Piper, who a lot happens to early on in the book. But Cornelia is always there and always commenting on what's going on around her, and has that same intimate kind of voice. It's just how it happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like that. It just sounds like you're a sort of intuitive, organic type of writer, which I think is wonderful, where you don't necessarily have to plan things out too terribly much to have something work very well.
Well, you know, what's hilarious about that to me is that I'm so not intuitive in many ways in my life. I'm not one of those intuitive women, you know. I wish I were. I am a planner and a list maker, and some might say a control freak in all kinds of ways. So and I always like to know why I'm doing something, and so it took a while for me to trust. That, and it took a lot of missteps. You know, it took me trying to write Claire's chapters in third and sort of trying to force that, and it just wasn't happening. I mean, or in first, I'm sorry, and it just wasn't happening. So even though my first instinct was to write in third, it's taken me a while, and it's still something that I have to sometimes step back and say, okay, look, trust yourself, you know. It took me a while to trust my instincts. And also, you know, I'd never written a book before, so I was learning. It was very much on-the-job training, you know, in all kinds of ways. With the third book, I'm finding it easier just to kind of have faith in those intuitive decisions that you can't explain, or that maybe you can explain in retrospect. You know, I'll think to myself, well, the meaning of this, or the reason for this, will come clear at some point. I need to just go with it because it's working. But it's just interesting because that's not necessarily who I am in the rest of my life, you know. I'm a planner and a, you know, a plotter. And so, but you learn, you know, and I think I've just learned to have, to take some things on faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, that helps. That helps, I think, in any creative venture, that you have to have that. Especially probably the more literary or the less going along with a genre. I mean, I suppose I would think that, say, romance writers or mystery writers have an easier time of it because there's a structure, sort of a structure that you're adhering to and going along with. Whereas when you're not doing a specific genre, you really do have to take a certain amount of it on faith, I think.
I think you do. And you know, the thing about, because one of the things I found myself doing recently, leading up to and while I'm writing this third book, is reading a lot of, I wouldn't say a lot, but reading far more than usual, which is usually none, of mysteries. And I love good writing, so I want the ones that speak to me in that way, and that I, you know, the writing is good. But some of these mystery writers, and what I feel, and I'm sort of asking myself, why am I drawn to these right now? I'm not writing a mystery. I'm not writing about, you know, there's no murder happening here. Why? And I think it has to do with plotting. I think it has to do with, it's amazing to me because mystery writers really have to know the whole, I mean, I'm guessing they really have to know the whole story ahead of time because everything has to fit in. And it's very puzzle-like in that way. And I'm not sure how that's going to play out with this third book, but I think in a way I'm taking myself to plot school. You know, I'm reading these mysteries where everything will matter later, and they're all very kind of tightly plotted. And but it is a different way to write because you have to know who did it, you know. And I'm not sure that you can write a mystery if you don't know who did it and why they did it and how they did it when you start. Whereas I don't know that much when I start. I know something, you know, and I've read about writers. I read an amazing interview one time with Elizabeth Berg, who writes literary fiction, and really, she just takes a character, and she has to know her character really well. But she what she says in this interview is that she just kind of sets the character down and sees what she does, you know, and the story grows out of that. And that would scare me. I mean, it would scare me to not know anything, you know, about where I'm going. I need a little skeleton plot, even if it radically changes, you know, and it does, you know, as my experience, which is pretty limited, but it does. It will change, and you'll go in unexpected directions, but at least I need to feel like they're scaffolding, you know, like there's a blueprint. Even if it's very faint and might not be the final, you know, the final version, but I need to start with something. But certainly I couldn't tell you the whole story ahead of time. And I think that's where mystery writers are amazing, because they really can.
Mm. You're listening to Writers on Writing. We have a little bit more time with Marisa de los Santos, author of Love Walked In and the upcoming Belong to Me. Let's talk a little bit about the business of the deal, which is, you know, getting an agent and selling the book. Can you talk a little bit about how that happened for you with Love Walked In?
Sure. And the thing that I always have to say about this, I mean, I haven't talked about it that much, but I have to say that it's not a typical, don't try this at home. It's not a typical experience. It's kind of, what happened to me was I wrote some essays in addition to poetry, and I was asked to contribute one to a collection, and the editor got my name from my poetry or something, and she asked me to, and so I did. I gave her an essay, and she had an agent, and that agent ended up selling this book, which has since come out. But some months later, after I finished that essay, the agent who represented her called me, or emailed me, I think, and said, I was the agent for this book, and I loved your piece. I know you're mostly a poet, and poets don't have agents. 15% of nothing. No agent's very excited about that. But anyway, so she said, you know, if you ever write anything longer, book length, I would love to represent you, or at least to read it. So I wrote her back, and I said, actually, last summer I started a novel. I have about 65 good pages if you want to see them. And so I sent them to her in an email attachment, and she called me a couple days later, and we talked. And in a nutshell, she said, I love to represent this. But don't say yes. Come to New York and meet me, and we'll talk. Meanwhile, of course, I had Googled her and found out that, and that it was, if I were going to have an agent, and this whole concept of an agent was very new to me, that this would be the kind of place I would want, sort of a boutique agency, not a big, mm-hmm. huge monster. You know, it was at the time two partners. Now there are three, but. You know, I thought, okay, and I loved the writers that they represented, and they did a lot of literary fiction and had a lot of women writers, and it just seemed like it could be a good fit. But she really was very adamant, you know, I'm not going to send you anything, we're not going to make an agreement, I want you to come, we need to click on a personal level. But of course I said to my husband, because at this point I had, after talking to some people, I had some idea of how hard it is to get an agent. And I said, look, even if I hate her,
you're going to take her anyway.
I'm going to do this. And he's like, oh, of course you are. Yeah, yeah, let's go. So I went up to New York. I went to lunch with her, and we ended up, I missed all these other things I was supposed to do. We stayed at lunch for like 4.5 hours. We loved so many of the same books. I loved her personally, kind of on site, and continue to love her personally and consider her one of my closest friends. And, you know, it just was one of those serendipitous, amazing things where when she talked about my pages that I'd sent, she didn't say, here's how we'd package you, here are my ideas for, you know. She said, this paragraph, this moment when, and I love that. And she said, and the rhythm of this sentence, you know, she talked about writing mm-hmm. the way a writer dreams of somebody talking about their writing. She really was so specific and so clearly in love with the piece and passionate about it, and continues to be this person. And so it was just really lucky. So as I was writing, because at that point I had, you know, 65 pages of what would become a 365 manuscript page manuscript. I would send it to her in chunks. You know, I'd send her, I'd write 100 pages, I'd send them, and we would discuss. And it wasn't big revisions, but there would be a little tinkering, and then I would move on. And then, so that when I was finished and we, you know, we both felt good about it, she could send it out right away. You know, that process started right away. And it happened fast. You know, she sent it to some places. It ended up going to auction. I think there were four houses, and it was all, I spoke with some of the editors on the phone, and we made our decision. So it doesn't always happen that way, I don't think, but it was just, and then my editor, who I ended up with, is, you know, she's perfect for me. If I could create these women in a laboratory to be my agent and my editor, this is what I would have come up with anyway, you know. So it just happened. I was lucky. That's really what it was. I got very lucky that we clicked so well, that we found each other. It's just...
Yeah. Well, it's true, though. I mean, it, you know, as you said, you would have taken anybody probably, because you just really, like, you needed an agent. You wanted an agent. But if in an ideal situation, to be able to, you know, even if you meet somebody and you don't click with them, to just take a little bit more time, because there are a ton of agents out there. And, you know, I don't know. I hear
no,
this.
No, it's true. And you know what? It matters because I have friends who have agents. Some of them are big name, you know, fancy schmancy agents, and they were so lucky to get them and they can't communicate with them. Mm-hmm. You know, they're afraid to call them. They don't hear from them for weeks. You know, it's not, and even though they're in what would be many people's idea of a great situation, they're feeling like it's not working because I realize that, you know, this is a business, and maybe all businesses are like this, where everything's personal, you know, where you don't have business relationships because you work so closely with people one-on-one, and if you don't like each other or you don't speak the same language or, you know, you don't have the same ideas about your work and where you want it to go, even if you're making money, it can still feel, you know, even if you're having a career, it can still feel wrong and it can still feel off. So, yes, I mean, ideally you get an agent. And, you know, when I said I'm going to sign no matter what, I didn't know anything. I don't know anything. All I know is here's somebody who wants to represent my work when I have 65 pages, you know, who has. And there was also a tremendous show of faith on her part because she knew I'd never written a novel, and it's not like I had a novel. You know, I had a little stack of paper, and she had a lot of faith in me from the beginning, and that mattered to me, too. So, you know, that's really what you want. You want faith. You want to someone who thinks about books and thinks about your writing the way you think about books and your writing.
Yes, yes. I'm curious, did the 365 manuscript pages, did they increase, decrease during revisions? Did it pretty much go to print at that manuscript page count?
No. Well, there was some tinkering. Mainly it was adding. I mean, my editor would say things like, I love this moment, but I think you bail out of it too quickly. Mm-hmm. I'd like to see you stay with it a little bit more. There was a little bit of addition. It didn't get that much longer. And then the manuscript pages don't translate to book pages. So
right.
I think the book was 320 mm-hmm. pages. And the manuscript maybe at the end was 375 or mm-hmm. something like that. But there was some dialing back of things like description or, you know, that things that amused me or that I loved writing, but that didn't necessarily serve the story. There was a little bit, there was some trimming, but there was no going in. And I mean, the thing about me is that I don't really show anyone anything that doesn't feel finished, at least in that moment, feel finished to me. So I'm not a writer who says, okay, I have 200 really rough pages, let's shape it together. I admire that, and I think that's another way to work, and it works for a lot of people. But for me, I'm almost phobic about showing anyone something that doesn't feel, that's not doing what I want it to do. So and I'm talking about, you know, on the level of the paragraph. And that's really how I write. You know, I don't put in placeholders. I don't write the end before I write the beginning. I'm a very plodding, you know, PLODDING kind of writer where I put one word and then the next word and then the next word. And I don't move on to the next sentence until I feel like that sentence is exactly the way I want it. And that's how it is for a paragraph and then a page and then a chapter. So, it's very kind of a lot of work up front, not showing anyone anything until there's a lot of polishing that's already happened. And then we go in and, you know. And what's great about an editor and, you know, about having readers who aren't you is that they say, you know what? What happened to, like, this whole day? Like, what happened to time here? You know, like, there are things that you just didn't see because mm-hmm. you were so close to it. You're like, suddenly it's the next day, but what, you know, so Or like they can just say, you know, okay, how did she get from the elevator to the restaurant? I don't understand, you know. So those kinds of things where there isn't continuity or it's confusing, you know, although it could be very clear to you as you write it. I love that. Had to have other eyes to say, and I was like, oh my gosh, how did I not see that? You know, how did I not realize that suddenly it's noon and we don't know what happened to these people for the past 17 hours? So whatever, something like that.
Well, it's been a delight talking with you, and this hour has flown by. Any real quick last words for the writers listening?
Well, I would just say, make sure, first of all, that you know your characters, that you have a story to tell, because I think sometimes people just are so eager to start that they start before they've really figured some key things out. You know, obviously I have to figure everything out. But then also, you know, trust your gut. If you can't write to kind of write as far as you can see and trust that when you get to a point where you're not sure what happens next, that more of the path will open up and, you know, some of those decisions also get made for you. So kind of a combination of know where you're going generally, but trust yourself when, you know, that you'll figure it out along the way, too.
Good advice. And thank you so much.
Oh, thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
It's been great. Thanks. That was Marisa de los Santos. Her book is Love Walked In. Her new book is out soon. Belong to Me, and her website is lovewalkedin.com. You can find out more, and what a fun hour. And we're at the end of our hour, so let me just say that, again, you're listening to Writers on Writing. My website is penonfire.com. You can email me if you'd like to be on my weekly email list. I'm going to leave you with a quote by John Steinbeck, who said, "The writer must believe that what he or she is doing is the most important thing in the world, and he must hold to this illusion, even when he knows it is not true." Thanks for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. My book is Pen on Fire. I'll see you next time.